Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton and I am the host of the show. The show is being streamed live over the internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air, by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. Once you're connected, you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in the queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. I'm really looking forward to today's show. We have two dynamic individuals who are dedicated to educating the public and changing the policies around prosecuting youth in adult courts and housing youth in adult facilities. Every year, an estimated 250,000 youth are prosecuted as adults in the United States, and on any given night, 10,000 youth are in adult jails or prisons. In Ohio, the practice of sending youth to the adult criminal justice system is called bindover. In most states, it's called transfer. We know that in Ohio, approximately 300 youth each year are bound over to the adult criminal justice system. For those of you that listen to our show on House Bill 86, we recently had legislative reform allowing for the reverse transfer in limited situations. We're not here to talk about that today, but if you are from Ohio, I wanted you to be aware that there are efforts underway, and that is why we thought it was important to find out what was happening nationally, since there are ongoing debates about youth crime, adult time, despite the pervasive research and the practice that's costly, harmful, and ineffective. So I know people aren't here to hear me, so I will introduce our guests. Tracy McCloud is a former high school teacher and current founder of Missouri's first family-led juvenile justice organization named Families and Friends Organizing to Reform Juvenile Justice. The organization works to reduce the number of youth in the adult criminal justice system and to create the best outcomes for all youth and families involved in the juvenile justice system. Tracy became a parent activist for juvenile justice reform when her 17-year-old son committed suicide while incarcerated in an adult facility. She has organized a 5K race in her community every year since her son's death in 2008. Her vision to take the races nationwide has now become a reality, with October being deemed National Youth Justice Awareness Month and more than 15 states sponsoring and participating in events. Liz Ryan is the founder, president, and CEO of Campaign for Youth Justice, an organization dedicated to ending the practice of trying, sentencing, and incarcerating children in the adult criminal justice system. Liz currently serves as the co-chair of the Act for Juvenile Justice campaign, an effort launched to reauthorize the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. Prior to starting Campaign for Youth Justice, Liz served as the advocacy director for the Youth Law Center's Building Blocks for Youth Initiative, a project to reduce the over-incarceration and disparate treatment of children of color in the juvenile justice system. Her work at the Youth Law Center involved campaign advocacy assistance at the national, state, and local levels to stop punitive juvenile justice legislation, redirect funding to communities, and increase involvement of the constituencies that were most affected by juvenile justice decision-making. So, Liz and Tracy, welcome to the show. I really want to thank you in advance for sharing both your personal and professional journeys here today. Liz, in your introduction, there was some information about Campaign for Youth Justice. Can you expound on that specifically? How did the organization come into being? And why focus on this subset issue of youth in the adult criminal justice system?
Well, thanks, Lauren, for having me on the show. The campaign was started 7 years ago this month by another friend of mine and myself. Her son was facing prosecution in adult criminal court, and she called me to ask me about attorneys, about experts, what to do for her son's case. And as we got talking more and more about that particular case, she asked Well, what would you do in multiple cases? What would you do to try to end the practice of placing kids in the adult criminal justice system? And I gave her some ideas. I thought we needed to do a national campaign because there had been very limited focus on this. So she and I together launched the campaign to reduce and essentially eliminate this practice nationwide. And since the campaign started, we've brought other people onto our team, and we're working collaboratively with families, young people, advocates, experts, researchers, and other folks all over the country to try to end this practice.
Maybe you can, I mentioned some of the research. What is the problem with transferring youth to the adult criminal justice system?
Well, I would sum it up in three main points. It isn't safe, it isn't fair, and it doesn't work. It isn't safe because when you put young people in the adult criminal justice system, oftentimes they're placed in adult jails or they're placed in adult prisons, and that they are the most at-risk population for physical and sexual assault in those kinds of facilities. It isn't fair. Many young people who are caught up in the system are young people of color. It's not because they commit more crime. The justice system responds differently and more punitively to young people of color. And it doesn't work. There's been a tremendous amount of research all over the country, some of it funded by the U.S. Department of Justice, some of it funded by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it shows that when young people are prosecuted in adult criminal court, they're much more likely to reoffend than young people in the juvenile justice system when charged with similar offenses. So this is not good for public safety, and for those reasons, we try to push back on this issue.
Tracy, how and why did you become involved with the campaign on youth justice?
Hi, I want to thank you for having me on the show as well.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, no problem. It's a pleasure. As you said in your introduction, back in 2007, I had a 16-year-old son who was arrested and certified as an adult here in Missouri. And when the process started, I was very isolated, very alone. I did a lot of research to try to find something else in Missouri for parents who had kids in the system, and I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find anything for parents that was run by parents. There wasn't any brochures or any information produced by the state of Missouri itself. There just wasn't anything for parents. So eventually, within 6 months, my son died in the adult system. And, you know, that just, I think my fear of what was going to happen to him once he died turned to anger. And so I really started stepping up my research and trying to find any other organization anywhere in the nation that worked with parents that had kids in the system. And, of course, I found the Campaign for Youth Justice within a couple of months. And through them, through their education and their support, I was able to found FORGE, which is named for my son Jonathan. It stands for For Jonathan, but it also stands for Families and Friends Organizing to Reform Juvenile Justice. And I resigned my teaching job and started doing advocacy work full-time.
How widespread, maybe Liz, you can talk about, are some of the things that Tracy described, sort of the lack of information, youth that are losing their lives. You summed up the 3 points, but is there some more research and stories that you can share?
Yeah, there's a lot of research and information about this, but I first want to just say what an amazing, amazing woman Tracy McClard is and the work that she's done. She inspires me and lots of other people around the country every day, and what she's had to go through and what she's advocated for on behalf of young people. And so it's with Tracy's leadership and inspiration that many, many other family members have come forward and contacted the campaign and got involved in these efforts. And now the families are linked through what's called the National Parent Caucus. And again, with Tracy's leadership, there's been a movement to launch and now expand nationwide the National Youth Justice Awareness Month. So I just want to say that first and foremost, it's really been through the efforts of Tracy and people who've been inspired by her who have come to the forefront on these issues. With the campaign, when we got started, we thought it was really critical that the information that the families have about what's happened to their loved ones and the young people themselves be front and center in this campaign. And so I mentioned the research, and the research has been around for a little while, and it's very important to show that research. But what we found is that when people tell their stories about how they've been personally affected, how their family's been affected, how their community has been affected, that has the most impact. So an example would be, Tracy testified before the United States Congress last year, and members of Congress who attended that hearing and heard her tell her story have still asked, their staff still call our office regularly because they are very tremendously impacted by that information. And I know lots of statistics and research was also presented at that same hearing, but the thing that they remember was Tracy McClard's story. So I just want to say that, to put that out there. From the campaign's perspective, we make the stories available on the website. We put them in all of the reports that we issue. We also do lots of different interviews with radio and television and newspapers. So all of those kinds of things are available on the website. We do talk a lot about the public safety argument because that's something that also resonates a lot with policymakers, the information about the research on recidivism. But there are a number of other things, I guess, that should be put on the table. And one is that there's very limited information about kids tried in the adult criminal court. Lots of states don't collect this information. But of the states that do, we're very troubled by what we know. We know that young people who are tried in adult criminal court, many are there for very minor offenses. Many are there automatically. There's no decision maker in that situation. It's because they're a certain age, charged with a certain offense, and they're placed in adult court automatically. We mentioned the issue about young people being placed in adult facilities. They are at the greatest risk of assault and harm in adult facilities. We also know that when young people are put in adult criminal court and they're sentenced in adult criminal court, that the consequences of an adult conviction are lifelong, serious, negative, and in some cases, very, very harmful. And so those kinds of things follow young people and impact their families and communities for the rest of their lives. So those are the kinds of things that we think that kind of information is available on our website, and we try to let people know about that. But we start first and foremost with the stories of the people who are directly affected, because that's what resonates with policymakers and with the general public.
Tracy, is there anything you want to add to that? Anything more about your story you want to share for our listeners?
Well, you know, I just agree with Liz. I lived it, and I live with it every day. And so when you get these families together, and when you get us in Washington, D.C., or in our own state capitals telling our stories, I mean, you know, we've been through it. When we hear each other's stories, it really impacts us, even though we know what it feels like because we've been through it, and you'd think, we're used to it. Well, every time I talk about John's story, my son's, or any time I hear one of the other parents' stories, I mean, it impacts us. And if it impacts us so much, you know, it's something I think that is a new branch when you're talking about reform and changing the efforts, because you have, you know, the lobbyists for the Sheriff's Association and the Judges Association, the Prosecutors Association. But, you know, like Liz said, the parent voice thing is fairly new within the past, 5 to 7 years, mainly since the campaign was started. And, you know, our stories are so horrible that their tragedy of them is what makes them so powerful, because, you know, you can't help but be affected by human tragedy, and that's what's happened to us, and, you know, that's what we live with every day. So it's just a powerful tool. It's very hard to share a story, but when you do, people remember it.
So, Tracy, it's been extremely important for you, and understandably so, Nat, I think maybe some of the listeners don't know your story fully, but to educate and empower families and parents, what do you recommend to parents whose kids are involved in the juvenile justice system and are either facing transfer or are already in the adult system?
Start telling your story and get involved in the National Parent Caucus because, you know, the National Parent Caucus is there for two reasons. One, it gives a lot of support and a lot of understanding to parents who have kids in either part of the system, whether it's the juvenile justice or the adult criminal justice system. There's a lot of support there, and, you know, you can get on and you can talk about what's going on in your life with your child, and people understand. You don't have to explain how you feel because people get it, I mean, because they've been through it. And also, because of what we've been through, you know, we're dedicated. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life until these laws get changed because, you know, this system took my son. And, you know, I'm not going anywhere. And neither are any of the other parents that deal with this because it's impacted us so profoundly that you can't not do something. You know, it's too late for my son. He's gone, but it's not too late to change other people's lives, other families' lives. And I think what really gets me is that the United States is one of the worst nations in how we treat our kids who are involved in the system. And to me, it's legalized child abuse. I mean, where else, or even if you were to treat your child in your own home like the system is allowed to treat your child and it's legal for the system to treat your child, we would be arrested. And we would be prosecuted for child abuse. You know, when Jonathan was in the adult prison, he spent the last month of his life in solitary confinement. He was 16 years old. What do you think putting a child in a tiny cell and letting him out every 3 days to take a shower is going to do? You know, and while they're in solitary confinement, you can't call them, you can't write them, you can't visit them. It's disgusting. And, you know, at the end of this time is when he ended up hanging himself. And, you know, there's just so many things that are terribly, horribly, disgustingly wrong with it that sometimes I just run out of words because it just gets me to the depths of my soul how wrong it is and how people can honestly do this to the nation's kids. So for other families, you know, stand up and tell your story and get the support that you need from other families that are dealing with it.
Well, we did have some questions, Tracy, about your story. I, you know, want you to share what you're comfortable with and know that probably both of you also want to make time to discuss what's happening across the country and how people can contribute to these changes. So is there a little bit more background that you feel comfortable sharing about, you've mentioned, you know, some of the practices such as solitary confinement and the lack of contact that you had during that time period. Is there some background you want to lead up to the experience, what led up to his death?
Of course, I'm willing to share because, you know, this is kind of what I do now. But so I guess what happened, and to try to keep it, you know, within the time frame of what we have, is Jonathan, you know, he was 16. He had just finished his sophomore year of high school, and he was very involved with a girl that he just thought he could not live without. She was 14 at the time, and she kind of had a rough home life, and she ended up breaking up with him, you know, a couple weeks after the school year ended, and she started dating somebody else, and she was kind of playing the two guys against each other. And just so people know, as I'm telling the story, I'm not placing blame on any of them. All three of them were kids, but this is just kind of the facts of what happened, at least through my eyes. So she started playing the boys against each other, just like a lot of young girls do. And Jonathan became increasingly worried about her. She was just feeding him a bunch of stuff that I don't think was true, but Jonathan did. And then drugs became part of the issue. He started taking drugs to kind of forget about the pain of losing this girl that he thought he couldn't live without. This went on for a couple of months until July 10th. And that morning, this girl called Jonathan to tell her that she was pregnant. And this other boy was going to force her to shoot up cocaine to kill the baby. And that she was going to commit suicide before he could do this and just kill both of them. So that afternoon, Jonathan ended up meeting this boy downtown. We live in a small southeast Missouri town, and the two boys ended up meeting, and Jonathan shot the other boy. And he survived, which is great, but he was, you know, seriously injured. He did have to have surgery, and he did have to have physical therapy. But thank goodness he survived. Jonathan, of course, was immediately arrested. He turned himself in because he said he had a good reason for doing what he did, and he knew the police would understand that he was saving two lives. And he had no intention of killing this boy. He just wanted to scare him into leaving the girl alone. And so as soon as he was arrested, he was suffering from shock and suicidal thoughts and deep, deep depression. So within 2 hours, they sent him to an adolescent psychiatric hospital in St. Louis. For me, it took me 2 days to find him. I kept calling the supervisor of the juvenile detention center where they initially took him, and they couldn't tell me anything. They just kept saying, well, he wasn't there, and they sent him somewhere, but he didn't know where. And anyway, so it took me 2 days to find him. And when I did find him, my husband and I went to visit him that first week, and he was a totally changed boy than what he had always appeared. You could tell he was in deep shock, and I'm not sure what else, but he was constantly rubbing the side of his neck to where it was raw. He was constantly rocking, which he'd never done anything like that before. And he spent a couple weeks there, and then he was transferred back to the local juvenile detention center, where he was given really high amounts of antipsychotic medication. It was so high that he was suffering hallucinations. He was seeing blood run down the walls. He was having this recurring nightmare of losing this girl and the baby over and over, the same nightmare. And I called the doctor that he had had since he was born and told him what medications he was on and the dosages. The doctor said that was way too much for somebody his age and his weight. And he called the supervisor of the detention center to try to reduce the kinds and the types of medicines that he was taking. And we were told that we had absolutely no rights whatsoever to change his medicines, and he would continue taking what he was taking. That went on for a couple of weeks until he was certified as an adult in October. And he was, that day that he was certified, he went straight from the courtroom to the county jail, where he was immediately taking off of all of those antipsychotic medicines, because some of them were narcotics and they have anti-narcotics policies in the jail. And there was no medical oversight whatsoever, so he went through serious withdrawal symptoms, shaking, hallucinations, seizures, you know, the whole gamut. And again, you know, we had no rights whatsoever there was no oversight, nothing. We didn't even know that they had taken his medications away until the next visit. From there, he was transferred to another adult jail because his case was transferred to another district because of the high media profile surrounding it. And I was still a high school teacher then, so on my breaks and on my lunch, I would call constantly to the new jail where he was being transferred because I was very concerned about his safety. Jonathan was 16. He was 140 pounds. He was about 5'8.5". So I was told, you know, over and over that they were very concerned about somebody that young and that small coming into their facility, and they were going to do everything they could to keep him safe, and they had other inmates that were going to look over him and blah, 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 blah. He was transferred on a Thursday, and in that facility, my husband and I were allowed to visit him for 15 minutes between 1 and 4 o'clock, either on a Monday or a Thursday. So he was transferred on a Thursday, so our first opportunity to visit wasn't until the following Monday. And when we went to see him, he'd clearly been beaten up. He had bruises and scars and scrapes all over him. He had a new tattoo under his eye that he was told by other inmates he had to have to survive. He just looked awful. His hair was shaved off. So, of course, I didn't handle that very well, and neither did my husband. Jonathan kept telling us, you know, to not worry, to not cry about it, because it was his fault. He'd gotten himself into this mess. And when the visit was over, we went to the supervisor of the prison to ask, or of the jail, it was a county jail, to, you know, ask what in the world happened, why was our son beat up, and we were told very coldly that things like this happen, what do we expect, and the next time he got in a fight, it didn't matter what it was for, that he was going to go into solitary confinement, and that was that. At that same visit, you know, Jonathan had a story about, you know, he always had horror stories every time we went to visit. This particular one, he said that there was this adult man that was brought in a couple days after he was there, and the other men that were in the jail drug him to the back, and Jonathan said, I could hear him screaming and screaming, Mom, and he said when they were done with him that they drug him back out, and Jonathan said, I couldn't even recognize him as the same man, and he said, and then he went into solitary confinement, and nobody else got in trouble, Mom. He said, this place is so creepy, and it's so scary in here. And so, you know, that's the kind of stuff that my husband and I and the rest of our family had to live with, just the constant worry, the total lack of ability to keep him safe. So he stayed there in that jail for until November of 13th, and then he was given a 30-year prison sentence. Despite the fact that Missouri has something called dual jurisdiction, which is run by the Missouri Department of Youth, and they will interview a child that's been certified as an adult, and they will make a recommendation to the judge to accept the child into the program or not. And I don't agree with blended sentencing, but in Missouri it works. It's a really, really good program, and it's exactly a place where you would want your child to be if they had committed a serious crime and you knew they needed help and you knew that they really didn't need to come home. But it's a place where they treat a child like a child, and they have intensive counseling and therapy. They can get their high school education. They can go on and get college classes. They have victim empathy. It's a really, really good program. It has, the last time I talked to the state director of the program, since it started back in the mid-90s, only 7 youth that have gone through the program have gone on into the Department of the Corrections. The rest of them have gone on and gone home and have become really productive members of society. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, at our hearing, Jonathan was highly recommended by this program, and it said that he had several reasons for being placed in the program. One is he had a huge supportive family. He grew up in church. He had a lot of goals, and he loved, loved, loved school, and he loved learning. And that was one of the hardest things for him when he went into the adult system, was the total lack of education. There was nothing there for him while he was sitting in the jails. And that really, really preyed on his mental health and the hope that he started losing really quick. When he was given the 30-year sentence, because he was still 16 at the time, he was transferred to an adult prison, but there was a juvenile wing. He stayed there for the 2 weeks in that juvenile wing, and he was allowed to take GED classes again. And we found out that he was too smart for the teacher that he had, and so he designed his own lessons, and he designed the lessons of the other child that was up there with him, and he ended up taking his GED test. And then the day after he took his GED test, I went to visit him, and he put his hands in his lap twice during a visit. You're not supposed to put your hands in your lap, but we were playing cards, and he just did it just out of habit. And so he was taken out and strip searched. I don't know what they possibly thought that I would bring into him, but he was strip searched. And then I found out after that visit, I found out about 3 or 4 days later, I called to ask about Christmas visits and found out that he had been placed in solitary confinement right after that. And so I wasn't allowed to visit him again. I asked how long he was in solitary, and I was told, well, 10 days, and this was the 14th, and I said, oh, so he'll be out by Christmas Eve, and then he won't be in solitary on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and then his 17th birthday was January 1st. And I was told, no, we didn't know exactly how long it would be, even though, you know, he was assigned 10 days, but holidays and weekends don't count, and, you know, we just didn't know. So the last time we visited him was on December 28th, which was, on December 30th, which was the Sunday before his birthday on Tuesday. And before solitary confinement, you know, he was on juvenile status, so we were allowed, we had a separate room where we could visit him, and there was this huge window that the corrections officers would stare through to make sure that you weren't doing anything you shouldn't. Once he was placed in solitary confinement, when we finally got our last visit with him, he was on the other side of a very, very thick piece of glass, and his side was barely big enough to allow him to sit. He had shackles on his ankles, on his wrists, around his waist, and we didn't have a phone to talk through. There was a vent on the side, and we had to shout through the vent to try to hear him and for him to hear us, because my husband and I were sitting in the regular visiting room, so all of their conversation was, you know, in the background while we were trying to talk to Jonathan. And then on that Tuesday, January 1st, he turned 17, which meant that he would be transferred into the regular adult population, and he was being transferred to another prison. And on his way to another prison, there was one halfway between where everybody goes when they're being transferred from one facility to another. And so he was moved to that facility on a Friday, and he was supposed to stay there until the following Monday. But on that Friday, on my lunch break, I called to the facility that he was supposed to be in, because I really didn't know where he was, because when they transfer them, they don't tell you when they're transferring them or where exactly they're going, but I assumed that he was already to the final place where he was supposed to be, and I called down there to ask about visiting, to ask about where he was, and I learned that, yes, he was there, and he was still in the solitary confinement building, and he would remain there until, you know, they decided to have a committee meeting sometime later that month to see if he would be able to get out or not. Anyway, it was just, it was kind of all an untruth, because after school, I had to take my husband to the doctor, and so I didn't get home until about 6 o'clock that evening, and I was planning on dropping my husband at home and then going on down to visit Jonathan, because they had visits until 8:30, and it was about an hour away from home, so I thought I could still get there to see him for at least an hour and a half. But when I got home, my daughter was at my house, and she had already moved out. I have 3 children. Jonathan was our youngest. But she was there, and she said the prison had called 6 times. And I already knew that he was gone, because the prison never calls you. And when you call them, you can't get any information. And if you can get any type of information, it's wrong. It's erroneous. They don't – it's just – So anyway, I knew he was gone. The only funny thing was she gave me the number to call back, and it was not the number where he was supposed to be, where I was planning on driving to visit him that evening. He was still in the place where everybody goes when they're being transferred. And so I called up there, and it took them probably 15, 20 minutes to transfer me several times to finally I got to the person that told me my son was gone. He had hung himself. About 3:30 that afternoon, when the shift changed, we found out later that there were all kinds of bets on him about who was going to have him and what they were going to do to him when he got down to the Charleston prison, when he got out of the solitary confinement facility or the house. You know, that's the story of what happened to Jonathan, who we lost, but it had a huge impact on our family as well. I missed tons of work, and I'm so thankful that the school district that I worked for was very understanding, and, you know, they allowed me to take off work whenever I needed to. But also, I told you I had two other children at the time. My daughter Suzanne was 22, and my son Charles was 20. And my Charles had just moved out, and he started having seizures and all kinds of panic attacks about worrying about Jonathan, and he tried to commit suicide, so he had to move back home. My daughter was in the military, and she was due to deploy right within 2 weeks after Jonathan's death. She, with that pressure on her, she also ended up in the hospital with panic attacks and anxiety. My husband also tried to commit suicide. And just to wrap it all up, you know, this is, it'll be 4 years this January that we lost him. And, you know, we've done a lot of healing, especially through this work. But to go back to the three youth that were originally part of this whole thing, the other two youth, my older son Charles has befriended, and he cannot talk about Jonathan without crying. Both of those kids have had to drop out of school. They've had all kinds of mental health issues, and they are still struggling to get back on track and to get over what happened. And if the justice system had treated this case totally different, held Jonathan accountable as a kid, and, you know, worked with all three of them, then all three of them would have survived instead of one of them dying and the other two still struggling to live normal lives. So I hope that filled it in a little bit.
Well, first of all, Tracy, yes, thank you for sharing all that. I know you started by saying, yes, that's what I do now, but each time it does take an emotional toll on you. And I personally want to send my condolences about the loss of your son. And I think, though, the story does demonstrate what Liz was mentioning about how the system, the lack of safety and fairness for youth who have been bound over or transferred to the adult justice system, and then also the conditions in adult facilities. I want, Liz, before I turn to you for any responses right there, I want to remind our listeners that they can call and ask questions live on air of Tracy and Liz by calling 347-994-1149, and then you'd press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, or feel free to put a question in our chat room. So, Liz, is there anything you wanted to add right now about? We didn't really get to talk much about the adult jails and facilities.
Well, a couple things I would add. Well, first, I just want to say to Tracy how courageous and brave. brave you are for sharing your story, and I know this has got to be really difficult, and I just want to thank you again for educating all of us about the impact of this issue. The one piece I would want to add would be that in light of these kinds of harmful and devastating impacts on families, a number of state legislators and state officials have started to change their laws in states to remove kids from adult jails and prisons, to get kids out of an automatic prosecution in adult criminal court, to change the way in which kids are dealt with in the adult system in terms of sentencing. And Neelam Arya, our research director, wrote a terrific report called State Trends that looks at the past 6 years and those kinds of law changes. So we're starting to see some movement, and we're encouraging people to get involved in any way they can. You hear Tracy's story and you want to know, what can I do? And we encourage people to take a look at this report, read more about Tracy's story and other stories on our website, and to think about ways that they can take action in their state.
Can you, you talked about the report. I think there's really like 10 states that have been highlighted. Can you give some examples of what states are doing? Because, and if you were sitting, people are listening, how can they find out what is going on and what are some creative ways to become involved?
Great. Well, in the report, there are four different trends that are identified. The first trend deals with the removal of young people from placement in adult jails and prisons. And, as you heard from Tracy, there just is a huge negative impact when you put a young person in an adult jail or prison, that they're either in general population where they're most at risk of assault or abuse, or they're put in isolation, oftentimes in solitary confinement for 23 and a half to 24 hours a day for long periods of time, and that could be devastating on a young person. We've seen several states change their laws so that young people can no longer be placed in adult jails pretrial or in adult prisons once sentenced. And since this report came out, several more states changed their laws as well on this, in this particular way. A second trend that we've seen is that in a number of states, at least 13 states right now, if you're 16 or if you're 16 or 17, you are automatically in adult court. You never see the juvenile justice system. So whatever offense you are charged with, you are dealt with right away in the adult criminal court. And several states have taken steps to raise the age of juvenile court jurisdiction to get 16-year-olds out of adult criminal court or 17-year-olds. Most notably, in the past several years, Connecticut, Illinois, and Mississippi have all taken steps in that direction. A third trend is reducing the automatic prosecution of kids in adult criminal court or getting kids out of adult court once they're there. So a number of states have said younger kids can't be in adult criminal court, or they've changed the way in which the adult court handles that case, giving an adult court judge authority, like you said you just passed in Ohio, Lauren. Some states have also taken that same step to say that the adult court judge has the authority to send that young person back to the juvenile justice system. And finally, the fourth trend that we identified in the report has to do with the sentencing for young people, recognizing the developmental differences between kids and adults, and giving young people special consideration if they're sentenced in adult court, giving them, I guess, less time and also an opportunity to have their case reviewed. So there are a number of these, and the name of the report is called State Trends, Legislative Victories from 2005 to 2010, Removing Youth from the Adult Criminal Justice System. There are lots of ways that people can get involved in this issue, and I would say the first thing is to take a look at this report and see what's happening in states around the country, see whether or not your state is one of the states that's made some changes or is on the brink of making some changes, and share that information with other people in your network. We also encourage people to take action right away. Don't wait. There are a couple things that you can do. upcoming on November 20th, MSNBC will be airing a film called Young Kids Hard Time, and that's going to be showing on MSNBC at 10 o'clock Eastern, and that's a great way to tune in and get more information on this. Invite your friends over, have a house party or a film screening and discussion with people to talk about the issue. And if those ideas don't appeal to you, we have a bunch of others on our website, which is campaignforyoustuff.org.
Great. We have a lot of people who listen in who represent family, children, and parents in both the dependency and delinquency court system. So on focusing on the delinquency, are there recommendations you have for attorneys on the ground that are representing youth that may face transfer proceedings? Just considerations. And Tracy, I really want to hear from you too on this, because I think it's really critical that attorneys are checking in with the entire family. So I don't know which one of you would like to start.
Liz, you can start.
Okay. Well, one of the things I would say to the attorneys is we do have information on our website about all the research studies that I mentioned. Trying kids in adult criminal court is more likely to the kids are more likely to reoffend if they're prosecuted in an adult criminal court, and other things. And so we have a comprehensive compilation of all these research studies, which could be potentially helpful for an individual attorney in a specific case. We also would encourage the attorneys, because attorneys have access to so much information, they know the families, they know the young people, to get involved in these efforts in their states. And I know the attorneys are oftentimes overworked and have many cases and don't have the time to do that, but they're oftentimes the ones in the best position to know how the law is being applied and who's being impacted. So I would encourage attorneys to connect with others and to connect the families with each other, so that they can share information with each other and start a support group and eventually launch a campaign in their state to change their state's laws.
And I would also add, to do site visits, find out what programs and facilities are in your state, and don't just have a head knowledge of them, but, actually go visit them, because, I feel like as in the state of Missouri, if we had more educated prosecutors and educated judges about the different options that there are for the kids and which ones really do work and which ones don't work, they could make more educated decisions about where to place these kids that will cost the states less money and will benefit everybody. So, that's one thing. And also, a lot of the systems people, they look at families as part of the problem, and that's a huge fallacy out there that if you have a child in the system, you must have done something wrong, you don't care about your child, where were the parents, all of those untruths that are floating around out there. You change your mindset and get a little bit educated about, who these families are, get to know them, have some sort of community event where you can invite the families in, kind of as Liz was saying, just a networking thing where you can invite families in and get to know who these families are, and understand that we love our kids very much. We want to keep them out of trouble. We want to help the process. Whereas right now, those of us parents who have had kids in the system, most of the time it's been such a negative experience that we no longer trust attorneys. We don't trust judges. We don't trust the police. We don't trust the system at all. And, sadly to say, that's where I am. I don't trust any of it anymore. And that needs to change, because there's no reason why the United States of America shouldn't have a judicial system that works with parents and works with families, and it's a win-win situation for everybody.
You mentioned a few, you mentioned several resources that can be located on campaignforyouthjustice.org, the website. Are there other resources either of you would like to mention at this point?
I will mention this. Hopefully we'll have copies of the film Young Kids Hard Time that we can send to people, and we'll have more information about that in a couple weeks, but we hope to be able to share that film and a discussion guide with anyone who wants to host a gathering with other family members, other young people, advocates, attorneys, people in their community.
And I know if anyone is on Facebook, that Campaign for Youth Justice, in your page you have a link to a trailer for that, if people want to see, and perhaps we can put it up on Children's Law site, on the Children's Law Center's website as well. People are unusually quiet today in our chat room, and I think it's because, Tracy, your story is so powerful, and people are really trying to let it all soak in. But I truly want to thank both of you. And do you have final thoughts you want to share with our audience?
The last piece of Jonathan's story is after he passed away, we got a box from the Department of Corrections with his things in it. And inside was the results that he had gotten from the GED test that he'd taken right the day before he went into solitary. And he had gotten a 99th percentile in the nation, which means, as a special ed teacher, that means you're the top. There's nobody under you. You are the 100th percent in that score. And so when they threw my son away, they threw away a future doctor or a future psychiatrist, which is what he was talking about doing. And, you know, we have no idea what he would have become. He had talked about discovering a cure for diseases. So, you know, you threw away something great, but we don't know how great it could have been. And so that's the final thought that I want to leave you with, is just, you know, think twice before we keep throwing our kids away.
Liz? Lauren, I'll just add that with that thought in mind, it really does impact all of us to hear Tracy's story, and I would encourage people around the country, there are people in your community who've been directly affected by this, and to reach out to people and to hear how it's impacted their family. As you can hear from Tracy's story, it really motivates people to want to take action on this issue. So I just want to thank Tracy again for her courage and for her amazing advocacy in getting this issue off the ground in so many places and inspiring so many people. So I thank you, Tracy,
absolutely,
for everything you've done and for your courage. And I would just say that I think that things have started to change because of Tracy's efforts and others. And with us all working together, I think we can turn this around.
Thank you. And I didn't want to lose the fact you had mentioned the National Parent Caucus that Tracy really helped start. Is there information on the website, on your website, about that too? Is that separate? Because I want to make sure people have access to that.
It's on the website, and Shantae Gray, who works here at the campaign, is coordinating the effort there, and two family members are the co-chairs of that group, Grace Warren in Illinois and Mike McIntosh in Mississippi, and Tracy is our national chair of the National Youth Justice Awareness Month, so we are so fortunate to have so many families involved.
Okay, great. Thanks. So I want to let our listeners know that our next show will be November 29th. We will have guests from the National Center for Lesbian Rights and the Legal Services for Children talking about helping LGBTQ youth involved in the juvenile delinquency system. And to stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. And we hope to hear from you and see you here next time on Spotlight on Youth. And Tracy and Liz, thank you so much again for sharing your stories. I echo exactly what you're saying, Liz, that Tracy, your story, out of tragedy, I think it's inspiring so much change. And thank you for doing that for us, for being here. So have a good weekend, everybody, and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth.